You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is November 24th, 2021. Sorry, I can't do the Sven Longstrength imitation. I don't have the British accent for that. Anyway, here in America today is Thanksgiving, so I am recording this on the 24th of November. There won't be a live show today. Since Americans are doing all kinds of things. So I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Last year we did Thanksgiving and all the myths and all the nonsense that people talk about, the make-believe history, the Indian stuff. So I found a paper that I did many years ago. It was called The Regime: Usury, Khazaria, and the American Mass. Now, that can, half my papers have something like that as a title. But this must have been 2015. And I wrote something. I wrote 15 assumptions that those writing the American Constitution had to have in mind in order for it to function. The Constitution was written in such a way that it wouldn't work, it wouldn't function, unless certain things were true. The assumptions, these were unspoken at the time, of course, late 18th century, because they were seen as obvious. They were kind of built into the social and civic life of the era. And you could say that they were, axiomatic at the time. And I say this kind of thing as a retort to those who deify the Constitution, that somehow the world that existed in the late 18th century somehow has a relevance to the utter destruction of everything that era stood for. And therefore, talking about the Constitution like it's this, sacred document doesn't make any sense. That world is long gone. The Constitution was not written for a massive crisis of drugs and usury and oligarchy. But I have 15 assumptions here. The first, capital was not radically centralized and was not seen to be capable of this. The creation of the conglomerate, especially in media and banking, makes capital far more powerful than the state. That wasn't even conceivable at the time. In other words, politics really doesn't matter today. Politics was not, it really today is not something that has much power. It's the economic elites that do. So the second thing is that the money power, the power to coin money and to regulate its value, will remain with the House of Representatives. That's the assumption of everything else that's built in to the political system that the Constitution designed. Of course, that's no longer the case. So then number three, given the first two, that the only oppression worthy of the name comes from the state, never from capital. Bankers were seen as a threat by Jefferson and other founders, but the idea of a massive global conglomerate dominating almost all the planet's wealth was not conceivable in 1790. Number four, that this state will never become large enough to have much of a standing army, let alone colonize the globe. In other words, government was a part-time affair. So when you're talking about empire, you're talking about politics, you're talking about how the branches of government should function. It was assumed that this was going to be a very small, part-time, almost a hobby with very little power, with very little enforcement, except in the most extreme cases. The Constitution in no way was written for this massive, massive administration like you have today. Number five, that Christianity, even in its 18th century watered-down schismatic form, will be the foundation of social life, including the family, local associations, and relations between the sexes. That this will not be amenable to public regulation. Now, what I mean there is that the basic moral norms, whether it be the various churches, the clergy, and the Christian, the Christian idea in general, would be regulating most of what today the legal system regulates, or really capital regulates. In other words, politics wasn't really that big of a deal, that the day-to-day functioning of society and family would have nothing to do with politics or legal regulation. Now, number six, that the U.S. would be more or less homogenous racially, or at least its racial components were strictly kept separate. Otherwise, racial demagogues would appear, destroying the unity necessary for even the simplest form of civic action. What John Adams worried about concerning class was able to become a problem for race as well. Adams predicted the rise of John Brown and the coming violence of anti-slavery agitation. John Adams is one of my favorite founding fathers, and one of the reasons is that he predicted what the slavery issue would eventually force on the country. He was vehemently anti-slavery, did not own them, and predicted clearly that the U.S. is going to be torn apart by this issue and a civil war is possible. He never used, on his estate, he only used hired labor. And again, this is something where, you know, racial violence, the use of racial groups against all our institutions was inconceivable. It wasn't going to be done. And the slavery issue tore the country apart, and then once the North was victorious, completely recreated the social life of at the time, the wealthiest part of the country, which was the South. Remember, the South's whole claim was that we make, whatever it was, 60-70% of the country's wealth, and that's being taken by Northern elites for their own purposes. The trade of Southern goods, you know, tobacco, rice, etc., is essentially financing the country that wants to destroy us. And John Adams was well aware of this. He was aware that this was a possibility, and therefore predicted that race was going to be used to destroy whatever it is that they created. And he was absolutely right. Slavery was an absolute disaster, and although it was profitable, it was a disaster morally, it was a disaster politically. Well, number seven, that Greco-Roman culture would be the cornerstone of education. In other words, when they talked about people who may be elected, they talked about people who may be voting, they were talking about a very specific, well-educated, independent group of, small group of men who were independent enough to make decisions without regard to, you know, racial violence or that kind of pressure, and certainly not the media or corporate pressure. In other words, they had a very specific group of people in mind, educated in a specific way, and having a certain level of independence. Of course, all of that is long gone. This is what they're assuming is going to be doing the voting and doing the debating. Number eight, that representation, I have that in quotes, that representation would be among groups of small property holders, having much in common in race, basic moral foundations, and culture, sending one of their own to administer the small government in Philadelphia or D.C. This would be a minor, part-time job that would lead to great levels of turnover in office. In other words, this is, you know, the basic unity, the assumptions that representatives would have when they go to the Capitol were very similar. You know, one of my favorite elections is 1960. Kennedy-Nixon. I recommend that you go and listen to those debates. There was one on domestic and one on foreign policy. Even there, even in 1960, you see a basic unity in all the assumptions about government and policy. The debates were entirely over administration, how these things were going to be done. Today, of course, the basic fundamentals of everything are challenged, even what government is for. And that, you know, I mean, the concept that white people would be considered evil, the Constitution written as a way to oppress non-whites, that it was going to administer this massive event, that was inconceivable. And it was inconceivable almost even in 1960, at least for those two who were debating and the parties that they represented. So the notion of representation had no, even 1960, had no bearing on what's happening today, and certainly in 1790. The people who were going to be considered politicians were essentially similar and would debate only basic, very specific areas of government, not fundamentals. Number nine, that conceptions of Roman aristocracy would remain for the senatorial rank and would also create the class of intellectuals. Senators were not to be elected so as to keep them from the vulgarity of the monosyllabic pageantry of modern election. Now, the Senate, in other words, was meant to be an aristocracy in every sense of the word. This was a highly educated group of people debating the basic, almost philosophical, aspects of government. That's why they couldn't be elected. It wasn't until the Progressive Era that senators were elected by popular vote. The whole point was to have a very high level of intellectual debate. I don't want to go so far as say it's a class of guardians in Plato's sense, but the notion of having a non-elected branch, they were supposed to be chosen by state legislatures, again, all with the same assumptions in mind, that this group was going to be, if they could discuss fundamental issues, it was going to be at that level with those assumptions based on the Greco-Roman idea of what that senatorial class was. And that was the level. Even, look at those 1960 debates, and you'll see that even then, the level of discussion was far beyond what your average middle-class American could follow today. Even their vocabulary. Most people cannot read the Federalist or Anti-Federalist papers. They don't understand the references. They don't understand the Roman. All they did is talk about Roman examples. They couldn't follow. Again, that's another assumption. And here, number 10, I said that ideological competition would be kept to a minimum. Basic moral and social agreement was necessary for any vigorous debate. You really can't debate fundamentals in the most extreme sense. You can't have a debate with a group of people threatening violence because of your race. You simply can't do that. There's no debate there when everyone's fearful of what the media may say about you. You have this elite group that enforces this ideological code based on threats. That's ridiculous. That wasn't the case even in 1960. Now, that debate shows a very, very different country, intellectually and just basic the basic assumptions that everyone had going into politics. And certainly an intellectual level. That doesn't exist anymore. 11. That local communities and the extended family would be the primary sources of socialization and social assistance. And divorce would be extremely rare. And it's very clear there that this is going to be a stable, intelligent, focused people who are voting, debating, and running for office. And by the way, they were all the same people. Debating, voting, running for office. This was a relatively small group of people socialized that way. Socialized in a very stable environment of the extended family, not the disaster that you have today. So even now they're talking about the founders were talking about a group that was very stable, that had no none of the neurosis that modern people do. You had a very small group of people, independent, educated in a specific way, and from that stable environment. Social assistance, socialization, all coming from the extended family, the church, not media, as today. Number 12, that foreign trade would be minimal, as would be the needs, the requirements of money. That really currency wouldn't nearly be as dominant as it is today. That you simply don't need massive amounts of cash to function. But that would be the very nature of what someone's worth. That someone is judged based on their connection to money. You can't run for office without massive amounts of money coming from outside sources. That's the nature of politics today. And of course, in terms of foreign trade, that international pressure would be non-existent. That this was going to be a strictly isolated domestic affair. Again, huge assumptions going into how basic debate and basic politics was going to function. Number 13, that the U.S. would remain an agricultural country, meaning that its people would be self-reliant and tightly connected to the rhythms of life, capable of feeding themselves in times of struggle. Again, you're also talking about a very small number of people. That the mentality, the neurosis of industry and banking, the obsession with money, wouldn't exist. That these families that I'm talking about would be self-reliant. That they're raised with the notion of self-reliance, not as individuals, but as communities. The extended family didn't see poverty, especially at this level at the time. 14, this is very important, that a free man refers to someone who was not dependent on others for their livelihood. That is, a basically self-sufficient landowner and production, the manufacture of objects, was the foundation of the economy. The nature of freedom was based on everything that I've said here. The nature of freedom was someone who didn't have to worry what a banker would say, what a boss would say, what the media would say. What arrogant, ignorant constituents who could easily be mobilized by the media and hucksters can say. Therefore, any debate that's happening now was the very opposite of what the founders built the Constitution around. All the things that go into, whether it be the separation of powers, the powers of the presidency, the first 10 amendments, all of these things assumed all of this. That this was the person going to be engaged in all of this. This was the person who was going to be in the judiciary, in the senatorial rank, that's going to become president. This was a very small group of well-educated, completely independent people. If you don't have that, then the Constitution doesn't make any sense. These were the assumptions that went into it. And the concept of freedom referred to specifically this man. So a free man, when founders used that phrase, that's what they're referring to, a man who was raised this way. And finally, 15, that these same men would be heavily armed and make up the primary law enforcement and militia of the nation. The whole notion that the judiciary now is meant to rule in anything they please, whatever the pressures of the regime wants, simply didn't exist. It's one group of people, politicians, debaters, voters, military men, policemen, at the local level and the federal level. This is all one small group of people. So when you, even something like the First Amendment, they're not referring to, you know, freedom of speech for just anybody. This was the set of assumptions that freedom of speech was meant to apply to. That's the whole point. Referring to constitutional ideas has to be connected with people who were raised this way and who lived in this environment. Any reference to the Constitution can't refer to anyone today. Referring to religious establishment. Well, the concept of a clergyman then and now, there's nothing in common. referring to religion at the time meant a clergyman that follows at least these 15 assumptions. Any reference to the right to bear arms has something to do with a man who was raised this way and who had these basic fundamental ideas behind him. So these 15 assumptions, they're very general, and it's just the beginning. Now, the loss of any one of these destroys the coherence and political ideas that inform the U.S. civic system. Now, of course, they're all gone. Not only all gone, few even know that they're missing. So references to the Constitution are simply incoherent. Yeah, that the First Amendment is applied to pornography proves this. The American political traditions, I've already said, was destroyed in the Civil War, and then the industrialization that came later. To be very general, oligarchy, in other words, the rule of a tiny group of alien, cosmopolitan, international leftists who despise the country that they rule over, was absolutely it was incoherent. This is a group of people who run the country. This is what I mean by oligarchy. And it ruled roughly from the First World War to today. Now, assumption 13, that the U.S. could remain an agricultural country, is, I think, particularly important. Because even for Adam Smith, the assumption that the main economic actor would be a self-sufficient, non-dependent producer, not someone working for a wage. And he would include, then and now, I mean, Smith in Scotland, who wrote his famous book in 1776, and the founders of the Constitution, they would include usury as a form of demeaning, unproductive labor, and certainly have nothing to do with economic growth. He saw the possibility, I'm talking about Adam Smith here, saw the possibility of dependence on foreign trade as very remote, resorting to only that where extreme need is involved. But to talk about using Adam Smith, using any of these people, writing at the time, to make reference at all to our current situation is incoherent. Adam Smith and Adam Smith personally, as an ideologist, could not envision the extreme mobility of capital or the total domination of finance regimes worldwide. You can't quote him talking about the world in 1776 as having a whole lot of relevance here. In a very general sense, markets function the same way. But what a market was, and who was running things, that assumption is very, very different. So it makes his analysis almost totally irrelevant to the postmodern era. So for the capitalist, the libertarian, to trot him out is indicative of a certain level of ignorance, except in the most general terms. Now, I use the word regime, you all know what that is. But with these 15 assumptions gone, or I should say, the regime can only function if these 15 assumptions are destroyed. The regime can never come into existence unless the assumptions that I mentioned no longer function, no longer exist. The regime is what happens when the cornerstones of culture are destroyed. The 15 assumptions that I mentioned, that's the basic fundamental world of the Constitution, of politics, of economics, really pretty much anywhere. With a few extreme exceptions, extremists during the French Revolution, the banking clan that was developing in the Netherlands, William of Orange and his successors. I understand that there are the destruction of these assumptions was already moving. But the founding generation in America, this is when they wrote anything, this is the man that they had in mind. And the result of this destruction, the creation of the regime, is based on the idea of the mass. Mass man, something I've been using my entire career, which is a technical term referring to huge numbers of superfluous people, not aware of any higher purpose. They suffer from abulia, a term that they've never heard. And I've said before many times, abulia is not mere lethargy, but a lethargy that comes from a profound alienation. And the regime, the ruling class, thrives on this. These assumptions were the cornerstone of a society that did not permit the mass man, that didn't permit the extreme alienation of the average elite or common person today. with a system of usuries based on debt. Debt buys more debt, and when it comes crashing down, the Shylock gets out of town. Now I'm quoting here from this same paper. This is many years ago. The usurer is a hated parasite, not a respected businessman. The regime found its origins in Babylon and Egypt, soon to manifest itself in Khazaria. The Khazar idea solidified its control in North Italy and the Renaissance, and more explicitly, the Jewish form of financial rule built when this capital moved to Amsterdam and London. It's one of the most important facts of modern life, really exclusively applicable to modernity, is that those with power seek to hide themselves. I've said 100 times that in Florence and Renaissance, the Medici family maintained the facade of the old republic while ruling all financial decisions from behind the scenes. So I wrote, they financed the art, literature, and science, that is alchemy, of the era while making it seem that these were spontaneous developments of a free people. Savonarola denounced precisely this, being sentenced to death by the Medici Pope, signaling an end to the Roman Church as a Christian body. Okay, that may have been a little extreme. To this day, professional historians will not deal with this question, lest they be called conspiracy theorists and find their tenure endangered. Modern academics are no different than television talking heads, partaking of the same bias and non-critical nature of contemporary thought, usury rules, and nothing else. And that's how I concluded this. This is how power functions. But the U.S. Constitution really did not, these assumptions weren't a part of it. Now, even there, things were developing. I've spoken at length about Shay's Rebellion and the idea of collecting debt and what that was all about. But still, they're talking about political debate, politicians, where ideas were going to come from, where laws were going to come from. None of that mattered. Politics was a part-time matter. The presidency was not was not this overwhelming, emperor like he is today, a celebrity in his own right, where every move is promoted by the press, where everything is now completely ritualized, lest the president be, only certain presidents be subject to the mockery and stand-up comedy that American politics has become. The masked man regime is created when all of this is destroyed. The idea of total dependency with debt, dependence on currency, dependence on media approval. Those writing the Constitution had no concept of this. And so I'm willing to say even after the Civil War, after World War I, but certainly after 1960, I do think the 1960 election was extremely important. The revolution was already being formulated, and Vietnam was very essential for that to develop. But after that, these assumptions fell to pieces. These are the sets of assumptions that anyone talking about politics in reference to the Constitution, really anything prior to the 20th century, has to keep in mind. Phrases like, there's a lot of false quotes. You see on YouTube, quotes from Thomas Jefferson, quotes from Adam Smith. Most of these are false. And you could tell that they're false because they use phrases like power to the people. When they talk about something like popular government, well, what is popular? They're not talking about media-sponsored polls. They're talking about the approval, the consensus of this group of people with these assumptions raised in a very specific way. And so when they refer to people, freedom, rights, duties, this is who they're talking to. Everything else was done at the local level. So talking about referring to any of the founding fathers, referring to anything mentioned in the Constitution, without referencing the fact that this was a very specific group of people that they're talking about, is highly problematic, I'm willing to say. It's not necessarily incoherent, but you have to qualify your point of view. you know, popular government representation. We use that word today, those words today. They don't mean the same thing as they did back then. The group of people, their audience, the sort of person that's going to be taking part in all of this, economically and politically, first of all, really doesn't exist anymore. And that person is what they had in mind. Talking about what the First Amendment means refers to the fact, it is referring to people who don't think like the modern mass or even the typical intellectual today. And that's extremely important to remember. There are some of us left who do know, who do follow and try to understand these assumptions as much as possible. It's very rare and very difficult. I know they really can't function in the world of American politics. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.